You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, testing the limits of wave-particle duality.
What we want to do is we want to generate a stream of very massive particles. So these are, in our experiment, little polystyrene spheres. And the question is if we can do a double slit experiment with those particles exactly in the same way as it has been done with light.
Questioning why humans experience the movement of time.
And you also attribute all these differences to the past and the future. So you think the future is open, ripe with possibility. The past is settled, done, over and done with. And yet you look to physics and you don't find any of that. My proposal was to look and see how, assume the physics is right about time, and why would a creature like us nonetheless claim that there's a flow?
And unpicking the paradoxes of physics with Jim Al-Khalili's new book.
There's now something called the quantum Zeno paradox. And it's now even been shown experimentally that we can really see this effect. So Zeno lives on in the 21st century in quantum physics.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Another month, another FQXI podcast, bringing news from the world of foundational physics. So, Brendan, how are you feeling today?
Actually, I'm feeling very particular. Thank you for asking. How about you?
Me? I'm wavy today, with a little bit of particle thrown in. A veritable mix of identities.
How very quantum mechanical of you. Whatever you do, don't collapse while we're recording.
I'll try not to. We are, of course, referring to the peculiar quantum property in which particles can behave like waves.
And waves can behave like particles.
This phenomenon, known as wave-particle duality, has been confirmed in the lab many times over. But it's been making the headlines this past month because two groups of physicists have carried out tests, published in the journal Science, that demonstrate this effect even more resoundingly. Those experiments also highlight the strange way that photons experience time, or rather, the way that they don't experience time. We'll talk about what made those experiments so clever in a little bit.
But first, to set up the wave-particle mood, we're talking about other experiments that test when this quantum property breaks down, being carried out by Hendrik Ulbricht, a physicist at the University of Southampton, UK. Physicists have seen wavy behavior in relatively large objects in the lab, including some organic molecules, which begs the question if large-ish molecules show signs of wave-particle duality, why don't we? Is there a boundary beyond which objects are too big to sustain quantum effects? And if so, where does it lie? Ulbricht, along with Tejinder Singh of the Tata Institute in Mumbai, India, and Angelo Bassi at the University of Trieste, have been speaking with reporter Karin Pikama about their tests to find the edge of the quantum world.
In 1921, Einstein was awarded a Nobel Prize in Physics, not for his theories of relativity, but for his discovery of the law of photoelectric effect. This law turned out to be crucial for the formulation of quantum theory. Since then, quantum theory, which explains the nature and behavior of matter and energy on the atomic and subatomic level, is seen as the foundation of all modern science and technology. But the theory has one major issue that continues to make some physicists uncomfortable. It's unpredictable. In simple terms, this means that it is possible for small particles to be in more than one place at the same time. For small particles, this may not be a problem, but scaled up to the classical world, the world we perceive, this breaks down. No object, including ourselves, can ever be in two places at the same time. This unpredictability of quantum theory bothered Einstein, and he summed his frustration up in the now famous quote, "God does not play dice." Tejinder Singh, a theoretical physicist at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in Mumbai, shares Einstein's sentiment.
He was never satisfied with quantum theory, and for good reason. And yet he became, almost ostracized to the extent of being labeled getting old. But all along he had a point, and what we are doing now seems to go very much in the direction, in a certain sense, that he was proposing, that quantum theory is approximate.
Together with theoretical physicist Angelo Bassi and experimentalist Hendrik Ulbricht, Singh wants to modify quantum theory so it can explain nature more precisely. With the help of a grant from the Foundational Questions Institute, Ulbricht is getting ready to test the theories from Singh and Bassi in his laboratory in Southampton in the UK. I caught up with all three to find out how the research is going.
My name is Angelo Bassi. I am a theoretical physicist, and right now I'm working at the University of Trieste. In a way, quantum mechanics is the theory, the only theory we have in our hands so far, capable to describe the behavior of microscopic systems. So particles, atoms, molecules, and in some cases also large collections of them. The way the theory was developed at the beginning of the 20th century was such that you are in principle allowed to talk only about the outcome of measurements. So perhaps a good orthodox definition of quantum theory would be is the theory that just tells you how to predict the outcome of measurements related to microscopic systems. So it doesn't have, in principle, nothing to say about the systems, but only about the measurements on the systems.
While this theory has been supported time and again over the past century, as Einstein already pointed out, there are nonetheless still real unresolved paradoxes in the very basics of the theory.
One of the most important problems is the so-called measurement problem. So why quantum mechanics is linear? So if you have two possibilities, you can have also the superposition of the two possibilities. The usual example is a Schrödinger cat. The cat can be dead, the cat can be alive, so also the superposition dead plus alive should be possible according to the theory. But we don't experience such things in nature.
The obvious difference between the quantum world and the classical world is size. This raises a string of interesting questions for Singh.
So we ask, why is that so? Why is that big objects, which are actually made up of small objects in any case, cannot be found in more than one place at the same time? And how big is big? A table may have, let's say, a few billion atoms, and we can call it big. How many atoms should I put together before a small thing becomes big?
Finding out when big is big and small is small might be key in solving the problem of superposition. And finding the exact boundary between them is precisely what Singh, Ulbricht and Bassi aim to do.
The global proposal is to test somehow the limits of validity of quantum mechanics, and in particular of the superposition principle, which is the most fundamental property of the theory among the many. So to test this property towards the microscopic scale. So at the microscopic level, the principle works. This has been tested frequently, daily, basically, in laboratories. At the macroscopic level, it seems not to work. So the idea is that in between the micro and the macro, the principle should break down. Hendrik is working on the experimental side. So to build up an experiment in the intermediate region between microsystems, so atoms, and macrosystems, so the Schrödinger cat. So work with this system in between, make them superimpose, and see whether the superposition remains in time or decays fast or slow.
Hi, it's Hendrik. What the theory basically includes in its basis, it says that every object in nature can be wave or particle, and it simply depends on what kind of experiment we do, if this object shows us a particle behavior or wave behavior.
This duality, where waves can be particles and particles can be waves, has interesting consequences. When a crest or highest point of one wave collides with the trough or lowest point of another wave, the two waves cancel each other out. It's called interference. Because particles can also be waves, this is true for them as well. Interference can be tested in a double slit experiment. To understand what happens in this experiment, try imagining a house with a big fence around it at night time. The fence obscures the house completely, except for three gaps where the planks of the fence don't quite match up. With the help of a street lamp, you manage to peek through one of the gaps to get a good look at the house. And you notice something funny about the light that filters through the other two gaps. There are not two, but several strips of light projected onto the wall of the house. As waves of light from the street lamp hit the fence and seep through both gaps, some of the waves collide and cancel each other out on the other side of the fence, while others are reinforced, causing this unexpected light pattern to appear on the wall. Now, if you were to shoot massive particles, like paintballs for instance, at the same two gaps in the fence, some would slip through, leaving two neat strips of paint on the house. But if we scale these giant paintball particles down to the size of electrons and shoot them at the fence, the pattern on the wall becomes multi-striped again. For this to have happened, the electrons must have behaved like waves.
What we want to do is we want to generate a stream of very massive particles. So these are, in our experiment, little polystyrene spheres, yeah, little balls. And they have a diameter of up to 100 nanometers, and they are relatively massive. And the question is if we can do a double slit experiment with those particles exactly in the same way as it has been done with light.
The largest particle that still shows interference, and so still belongs to the quantum world, is 7,000 times heavier than a hydrogen atom. To test particles heavier than this, Ulbricht has to overcome huge technological difficulties.
We have a particle source, so we can generate particles in an optical trap. So the experiment has to be done under very clean conditions. So that means that the particle has to be alone, which means the particle has to be in ultra-high vacuum, which is at very low pressure. So 10 to minus 10 millibar is the pressure we have to reach in a vacuum chamber. And what we are now working on is to basically bring this trapped particle into the vacuum chamber. Yeah, so that would be a big technological step. We don't have a solution at the moment, but we are working on it.
But getting the particle into the vacuum chamber isn't Ulbricht's only problem. Once the particle is in place, he needs to adjust the double slit experiment to make it possible to test the larger particles.
You have to realize a double slit for this single particle so that when we release the part, it falls through the double slit just in the gravitational field of the Earth. But there are many complicated challenges and problems which we have to overcome to do this experiment.
But despite these difficulties in finding at which point exactly quantum theory might break down, the group has already started thinking about why superposition doesn't seem to exist in the classical world. One idea that they are excited about has also been championed by Roger Penrose, a mathematical physicist at the University of Oxford. Here's Singh again.
Many of us, all three of us in the team and a few others, including people like Roger Penrose, believe that gravity has a lot to do with why large things look classical. Parts of our theory do show that gravity is what is responsible preventing a table from being in two places at the same time.
And here's Bassi again to explain why gravity might hold the answers.
If you want to kill quantum superposition at the macroscopic level, so that Schrödinger cat is not dead and alive, but just either dead or alive, then you need some nonlinear phenomena. Your superposition principle is linear. If you want to kill the superposition, you need something nonlinear. And gravity precisely has this character. The theory underlying gravity, which is general relativity, is a strongly nonlinear theory. So if you have two possible curvature of space-time, the superposition is not a solution of the equations, so it's not a possibility predicted by the theory anymore. And this is precisely the idea of Roger Penrose. When you create a quantum superposition, so cat, for example, in one room and cat in the other room, then you have two different gravitational potentials created by the cat, and gravity doesn't like these two superpositions of gravitation and kills them.
If Ulbricht does find in his experiments that there is a point at which particles are so large that they no longer also behave as waves, quantum theory will need to be modified. A century after Einstein raised his concerns with quantum theory, we might finally learn that God does indeed not play dice. While many scientists might be reluctant to modify quantum mechanics, physicists like Bassi relish the idea of change.
We live, in some sense, in one of the most exciting moments in the history of science, because we come from a past of amazing successes. So there was classical mechanics, then we had in 100 years, we had such revolutions as statistical mechanics, special relativity, general relativity, quantum mechanics. So we have a completely different understanding of the world, and this is very exciting. But it's clear, at least in my eyes, that we are missing an important piece of information about the world around us. And we should look for something else. And this is really, I mean, it's amazing that we are in this position.
Thank you to Heinrich Ulbricht, to Jinder Singh and Angelo Bassi for speaking with Corinne Pickema there. You can read more about Ulbricht's experiments in an article on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I liked Corinne's description of the classical double-slit experiment that is used to demonstrate wave-particle duality. A variation on that experiment was proposed in the 1980s by physicist John Wheeler to try and catch out photons, or particles of light, in the act of deciding whether to behave as particles or as waves. His proposal for what's known as a delayed choice experiment has recently been modified and tested by two groups, one based in the UK and one based in France, who have shown that photons retain their dual identity even when you try to trick them.
Yes, so the standard double-slit experiment can also be carried out by firing light from a laser at the wall with two slits. Now, historically, light was thought of as a wave anyway, so it might not seem that exciting to discover that when a beam of light hits the two slits, it splits into two waves that proceed beyond the wall and interact on the other side, creating a characteristic interference pattern that can be picked up on a background screen. The strange part really appears when you tune down the laser so that it only spits out one photon, so one particle of light, at a time. In that case, you might expect the wave interference pattern to disappear because a single particle of light can only travel through one slit, either the left slit or the right slit.
Right. So basically, because you're shooting single photons at the slits, like bullets fired from a gun, you'd expect that roughly half would go through one slit and half would go through the other. And if you look at a screen lying beyond the wall, you'd expect to just see two clusters of light lined up with the two slits. You would not expect to see wave interference at all.
But what you actually see is that the interference pattern remains. Even a single photon exhibits wave-like behavior, somehow traveling through both slits at the same time, splitting and interfering with itself on the other side of the screen to build up that characteristic wave pattern.
That's not all, because photons do not like being spied on. So if you place a photon detector at each slit to try and see which path the photon takes and how it manages this feat of traveling through both slits at once, well, then the obstinate photon reverts to behaving like a particle that travels through only one slit and not the other, and the wave interference pattern vanishes.
Very crudely put, it's as though the photon approaches the double slit and makes a note of whether or not there's a photon detector sitting there waiting for it. If there is, the photon decides to act like a particle and pass through one slit. If not, the photon decides to act wavy and pass through both.
Which is just crazy. And finally gets us to the delayed choice experiment outlined by John Wheeler, which is designed to fool the photon, forcing it to make its choice over whether to act as a wave or a particle before the experimenter tips it off about whether or not she is going to measure its path. Wheeler suggested that instead of placing photon detectors at the slit, you could move them farther away. In his setup, the experimenter only chooses whether or not to use these detectors to gather information about which path the photon took after the photon has already passed through the slits. So the photon, in theory, should have to decide whether to behave as a wave or a particle before knowing whether the person carrying out the experiment intends to spy on the photon's path or not.
Cunning. So, does it work? Can you outwit the photon in this way?
Well, no, evidently not. A couple of weeks ago, two teams, one led by Florian Kaiser at the French CNRS Institute and the other by Alberto Peruzzo at the University of Bristol, UK, showed that photons cannot be outfoxed by performing tests that were a kind of variation on this one. They didn't use the exact setup that we outlined here, and this isn't the first time Wheeler's delayed choice experiment has been carried out, but the two tests confirmed again that photons can seemingly delay the choice. The choice about whether or not they behaved like particles or waves in an experiment carried out earlier, based on lab measurements that are made after the photon already exited the apparatus. There are links to the papers that appeared in Science on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Photons. They have no respect for time or causality.
They mock us and our puny minds. The laws of microscopic physics don't differentiate the future from the past, so why must we be locked into this belief that time flows?
You're in luck, Brendan, because that's exactly the question that Karine Pickemer has put to philosopher of physics Craig Callender at the University of California, San Diego. Callender has been trying to understand why our perceptions are in conflict with ideas about the nature of time in physics, using ideas from human biology, psychology, and cognitive science to help him. He has come to the conclusion that our sense of a flow of time is intimately tied to the illusion that we have an enduring self, as Karine found out.
When time goes by, time is valuable, and when it's gone, it's gone. You may delay, but time will not. These and numerous other sayings, songs, and stories about time all suggest that time is forever pushing us along, flowing from moment to moment, never faltering, never looking back. This idea of a past, present, and future all connected makes intuitive sense to us. But the real nature of time, the way physicists have understood it since Einstein's theories of special and general relativity, looks nothing like this linear flowing time we know and understand. According to relativity, time is just another dimension alongside space. We live in a four-dimensional block universe with the past, present, and future all mapped out. There is no unique now that everybody agrees on. Instead, different people who are moving relative to each other can disagree on the order in which events happen, and when now actually is. And there is no flow of time. So one of the big mysteries, therefore, is why we humans perceive time the way we do. This complex metaphysical question is the subject of a grant awarded by the Foundational Questions Institute to Craig Callender in 2010. I caught up with Callender on Skype to find out how far he has come in answering this question.
Hi, I'm Craig Callender. I'm a philosopher of physics at the University of California, San Diego. My educational background is in philosophy, although along the way I learned a lot of physics, so I have a degree in philosophy, but a lot of interest and experience in physics.
What is it exactly that you proposed in your grant for the Foundational Questions Institute?
I propose to look at manifest time and how it relates to scientific time. Manifest time is when you divide the world in this global tripartite structure, past, present, and future. And you also attribute all these differences to the past and the future. So you think the future is open, ripe with possibility, the past is settled, done, over and done with. And that really matters if you think about it, the way we live our lives. And yet you look to physics and you don't find any of that. There's just none of it. You just don't have the structure in the physics to even go about describing this tripartite structure that is really, you know, the time you live by. My proposal was to look and see how, assume the physics is right about time, you know, why would a creature like us nonetheless claim that there's a flow?
But before we delve into the research Callender has done in trying to understand why we humans are so stuck on dividing our time in past, present, and future, let's take a closer look at the nature of time as physicists understand it. Dr. Emmanuel Olaya, a particle physicist working at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxford in the UK, explains.
Time's a quantity that we're all very familiar with. However, physicists, we prefer to describe the world from a perspective of both space and time. And the timing is different between physical systems. A physical system is the point from which you make your measurement. And this difference in timing between the two physical systems is a consequence of the theory of special relativity. Now, this is a theory that Einstein came up with in the early 1900s. And basically, the foundation of this theory is that light travels at the same speed no matter what. If I was to set off at the speed of light at the same time you flashed a light both heading towards a planet, an observer on the ground would see me and the light moving both at the same speed side by side. And you would expect that I would look at the light and see the light being at the side of me moving at my speed, as in it would be stationary with me. However, what actually happens is that I would observe the light moving away also at the speed of light. So as a consequence, there's two different observations there. The observer on the ground sees one event where we both reach the planet at the same time, and I see a different event where the light reaches the planet first and I reach the planet second. To show how significant this effect could be, let's take, for example, two identical twins, one who's an accountant and one who's an astronaut. And let's say the accountant's based on Earth, stationary, and the astronaut has a 10-year project travelling the solar system at the speed of light. So let's say after the 10 years he comes back to Earth and the twins meet. Now if you look at the age of the two twins, because one twin has been travelling at the speed of light for 10 years, his age is different. The astronaut is younger than the accountant, and that's a real physical effect. There is now an age difference because of this effect of special relativity. The closer the astronaut travels to the speed of light, the greater this effect will be.
But of course, even the fastest vehicle on Earth doesn't travel anywhere near the speed of light, and so we don't see these dramatic relativistic effects in our everyday life. The time lags we could potentially observe are much smaller, and so it is not obvious to two people having a conversation, for instance, that they do not actually share the same now. One of the reasons for this, according to Callender, is that the time differences are small enough for our brain to trick us into believing that separate occurrences are in fact part of the same temporal event.
An explosion happens, emitting sound, light, heat, pressure, all sorts of things that are all impinging on you. How do you put it together so that you think that all of those things come from the same event? So we have these interesting mechanisms so that when the sound is coming much later than the light, as long as the sound comes within about 250 milliseconds of the light, your mind will bind those two together and you'll think of them as simultaneous. And so you have lots of things like that also with the other sensory modalities. People differ in what they bind together, but on average, you know, they'll agree quite a bit, especially as the timescales get bigger. So I can point to something and say, look, the couch is red. And in the time it takes me to say that, and for the time it takes for you to process that, the couch is still red. So the way I'd like to put it is that the lag times don't typically falsify the beliefs that are generated in the relevant timescales for salient macroscopic events. So you have all these creatures then going around with roughly the same integration mechanisms, trapped on the time-like trajectories. And so it makes sense that they would all think that there was a common shared now. This is never going to be any just confirming evidence of this at the macro scale.
But it is not just a trick of the brain. Callender thinks that perhaps our tendency to care more about the future than about the past also contributes to our perception of time.
You know, if you think about a headache, and you think about whether you care about past headaches versus a future headache, those past headaches, well, they're over and done. Who cares about them? They probably wouldn't pay that much for eliminating a past headache. But if I told you you're going to have a really excruciating headache, you know, in 10 minutes, you'd probably pay quite a lot of money to, if I could, you know, in some way make that go away. But you would never pay that same amount of money to have that the headache from 10 minutes ago go away. The reason why you care about the future headache is because it seems like it's something you can cause, and the things you can cause, you feel greater emotion about, greater intensity, and so it makes sense that it would have greater care about it as opposed to the past.
Clever integration of information in the brain and a greater stress on the future compared to the past go some way in explaining why we perceive time the way we do. But these tendencies don't explain very well yet why we see time as a neat flow from moment to moment. Callender has come to the conclusion that our sense of self has a major role to play here.
We do have this idea of a self, and you think of the self as this enduring object, and memory plays a role because we have all these autobiographical memories. We don't just have memories of, you know, Lincoln was assassinated, but we also have all these memories in which, you know, the spatial-temporal context of the memory itself is in the memory. And you are using these to create this kind of narrative. So if you think about it, you've got this four-dimensional world line on the manifold, and it's just there. There's no flow or anything. But it's telling itself this story based on these asymmetric structure of memories. And the story is a story about this self. And crucially, you think that that self is all there at once, at every single moment. You know, so I've got a left arm and a right arm, and I think of those as parts of me, but I don't really think of the baby version of me and the old man version of me as parts of me. I think of the self as all here, you know, all the time. Everything's changing, but not me. But really, of course, I am changing, but the story of this self isn't. The illusion of time flow is due to the illusion of an enduring self.
Callender has approached his question by thinking way beyond the boundaries of physics, by combining ideas from human biology, psychology, and cognitive science. He has created an interesting theory as to why our perception of flowing time is so hard to shake. He intends to publish his findings in a book. And where does he see his research go in the future? Well, the future seems ripe with possibilities.
I think by New Year, I'll have a draft of the whole book. I'll probably go on with the research afterwards, but it'll be the end product for now. I've been working on time and physics for, I don't know, almost 20 years, and so I think I'm going to branch out a little bit, but I'm sure I will still be interested in it because it's such a great topic. You know, these different areas where I think Kongsi, and there are probably many other areas in which you could try to do a similar analysis. And so as these ideas occur to me, then I'm bound to come back to them.
Craig Callender and Emmanuel Olaya were speaking with Karin Pikema there. You can also learn more about Callender's attempts to slice space-time sideways in order to understand the origin of the arrow of time in a video and article about his research on our website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. All this research into the human brain is tiring mine out. Thank goodness we're getting into the holiday season, and I could take a break to ponder how to make sense of all these paradoxes.
Then let me recommend some holiday reading for you. In his new book, Paradox, The Nine Greatest Enigmas in Physics, Jim Al-Khalili, a physicist at the University of Surrey, UK, brings together some classic conundrums, going back to ancient Greece, through thermodynamics and special relativity, up to quantum mechanics. It even touches on the physics of information.
Aha, the topic of FQXI's latest grant round. I like the sound of that.
I recently met with Al-Khalili, who told me why he decided to devote a book to various physics paradoxes and how these classic puzzles still have plenty to teach scientists today.
Well, I think probably the overriding reason for why I am passionate about physics is because the universe is one big puzzle. It's one big riddle that I want to solve. And a lot of issues, particularly in modern physics, have been cast in the form of paradoxes. Now, we believe that nature doesn't behave paradoxically. So if we force a paradox when we're trying to understand a particular phenomenon in nature, it probably means we haven't understood it properly. So forcing a paradox is a way of finding out where the gaps in our knowledge are. And so I wanted to collect together some of the best known paradoxes in physics. Many readers, people who follow science who are not scientists themselves, will have heard of these paradoxes, the names, but won't probably know that they've been resolved or the science behind them.
And so how did you choose which ones to tackle?
Well, a lot of the paradoxes come from modern physics, quantum mechanics and relativity theory, and they're ones that I'm familiar with because I teach them to my own undergraduate students. So paradoxes involved with relativity theory and to do with time travel, paradoxes to do with Schrodinger's cat in the box, both dead and alive at the same time. These are ones that I'm familiar with, and I also know they're the ones that capture the imagination. The real issue was, where do I stop? You know, there are paradoxes that are rather obscure, and the science needed to explain them away, I felt, may have been beyond the remit of a popular science book. So I had to sort of make a decision as to where I do the cutoff. But I think I've captured essentially the best loved paradoxes, both by physicists and non-physicists.
So the first chapter deals with mathematical paradoxes, some of them that go back to ancient philosophy. One that I picked up that I think lots of people have heard of but maybe haven't gone into in great detail is Zeno's paradox.
Yes, in fact, Zeno, who predates some of the more the better known philosophers of Greece like Aristotle and Plato, he came up with a number of paradoxes. The one I describe in the book is the paradox of Achilles and the tortoise, which is sort of very much like the hare and the tortoise parable. What Zeno wanted to get across was the notion that there was no such thing as motion and that time was an illusion. We now understand that he was being naive. He didn't know that speed equals distance divided by time, for instance. He certainly didn't know the concept of a geometric series, which is what is needed to resolve some of these paradoxes. But what's fascinating is that Zeno's paradoxes have re-emerged in modern times. One particular paradox, which I do talk briefly about in the book, is the paradox of the arrow. The idea that an arrow in motion, if you take a snapshot of it, it's not moving. So there's no such thing as motion. If you keep looking at it all the time, it's never moving. There's now something called the quantum Zeno paradox, which is rather different. And it's to do with the idea that in quantum mechanics, when you make a measurement, when you look to see what a subatomic particle is doing, for instance, then you force it to behave in a particular way. You affect, your observation affects its nature. And if you think of a radioactive atom, an atom whose nucleus will spit out a particle, if you keep looking at it, you will force it back to its initial state. Another way of saying this is, the watched pot never boils, which of course is nonsense, it does, but the quantum Zeno paradox, it turns out to be really true. The watched atomic nucleus should never decay, and it's now even been shown experimentally that we can really see this effect. So Zeno lives on in the 21st century in quantum physics.
Is there any way that we could use that or exploit that effect in the lab? Is that something that physicists have been thinking about?
It certainly is. I mean, it's still somewhat speculative, but certainly physicists are exploring both Zeno's paradox, whereby you slow down a process, like a particle quantum tunneling from one place to another. But there's also something called the anti-Zeno paradox, where by looking, you force it to speed up, to do something more frequently. And so Zeno's paradox, anti-Zeno paradox, are really areas which are being explored in quantum physics, quantum optics. We don't know yet what use or application it may have. We just want to confirm that we can really control the quantum world.
Just going back to something that you said about Zeno's paradox, Achilles and the tortoise, you used the term geometric series. And, you know, that's a mathematical term. Some of us have learnt it in school. Some of us have forgotten what it means. But actually, looking through your book, you don't go through very much mathematics. So was that difficult for you to do?
No, not at all. I think it's perfectly acceptable and doable to explain in modern physics without the use of mathematics. And I think a lot of professional physicists would argue that by removing all the maths, we're dumbing down. I hate that phrase, dumbing down. For me, that just means the professional physicists themselves are not imaginative enough to find the right language to explain their concepts to an audience who perhaps haven't spent the last 20, 30 years solving equations. Where some of the paradoxes I talk about do need a bit of maths, then I give them that little bit of maths. But I don't think it's maths that would be beyond anyone, you know, who's not got the rudiments of high school education and maths. It's doable.
So at FQXI, we've recently launched our Physics of Information grant, and we're going to be giving money to researchers who are looking into foundational questions that address what information actually is and how much it can affect the physical world. And I think one of these paradoxes touched on that. It's the paradox of Maxwell's demon that people who've studied thermodynamics might remember. Can you tell us a bit more about what that's about and why it's interesting in terms of information?
Yeah, this was the hardest chapter for me to write, Maxwell's Demon, because it's so subtle. And even among professional physicists, there's not really a consensus, agreed way of explaining it away. The idea is that the second law of thermodynamics, one of the most important principles in physics, says that hot objects cool down, essentially, and stuff that's ordered and neat will gradually over time become more disordered. James Clerk Maxwell, the Scottish physicist, said, well, how about this? If you had a box full of air and you had this hypothetical demon who could sort out the air molecules, the fast on one side, the slow on the other, just through knowing how fast these molecules are doing, then through information alone, he could create a box where you have hot on one side, cold on the other, violating the second law of thermodynamics. And the resolution of this paradox only came about when we understood what information really is. And it turns out information is actually part of the physical universe. It's not just an abstract concept. Information almost is interchangeable with energy, with work. So having information is like having a charged up battery.
So having information in this sense, I guess what you're getting at is that in order to resolve the paradox, you have to remember that Maxwell's demon has information, that information is power, I guess.
That's right. I mean, essentially, you have to break it down to what's going. Maxwell's demon has a brain, has a memory. So if it knows all the speeds and positions of all the molecules of air, through that knowledge, it can sort them out. But what's happening is that the disorder that you had originally in the box that has now become ordered has been transferred into the demon's memory, into the demon's brain. We talk about a concept called entropy. The box has high entropy, high disorder. The demon can lower the entropy of the box, make it more ordered, by increasing the entropy in its brain. And so overall, when you talk about demon plus box, the second law of thermodynamics is never violated. Entropy overall is always going up all the time.
Okay, well, thank you very much and good luck with the book.
The book is out now, and I'm particularly keen on the front cover of the book because it's Schrödinger's cat inside an Escher cube. It's a double paradox in one picture. I love it.
It is a lovely picture. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Jim Al-Khalili for talking to Zia. There's an extended version of that interview in which he discusses his own research in the burgeoning field of quantum biology and his work as a science communicator on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. So, Zia, is the book any good?
It's a fun read. For regular listeners and visitors to the site, many of the ideas covered will be very familiar because Al-Khalili goes through a lot of classic examples in quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger's cat paradox, parallel universes, and also in special relativity like the twin paradox and problems about length contraction. So those are probably aimed more at complete physics novices. But I really enjoyed learning about some puzzles of probability that I hadn't encountered before. For instance, he mentioned some that revolve around game show mathematics, trying to work out what your best strategy is for winning certain challenges posed on TV quizzes. He also works through some complicated thinking quite painlessly, and you can have a try and play along and get to the answer before he does. Plus, like he says, it's got a great cover, Schrödinger's cat inside Escher's cube.
I think we all need to take some time to imagine that. If any of you do read the book and want to tell us what you think of it, then you can comment on the website's podcast page or contact us at podcast@fqxi.org or via Twitter @fqxi. That's all for today, so thank you again to Tejinder Singh, Hendrik Ulbricht, Angelo Bassi, Craig Callender, Emmanuel Alaya, and Corinne Pikema.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.